I'm Bill Smith. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, Milton's already told us we couldn't do any of this carrying on up here. Last time I talked up here, Milton was off talking somewhere up in Indiana or somewhere. He said, Bill, watch your language when you go over there. And I've tried to clean up my language. But I'm really grateful to be here and appreciate y'all asking me back. And I noticed in the last couple of days that I've seen a lot of people here that were here the last time I was here. And y'all keep up the good work. And I see some of the old timers are gone. So I say the same thing everywhere I go. Keep the tradition going. You people who are younger in sobriety continue to support this thing when the other people aren't able to. They may not be dead, but they're just not able physically to do the things. It's a rewarding thing. I when I was in California in 1973, my sobriety date's the 9th of January, 1975. But in 73, I was first put in treatment with the military. And these people said they just couldn't wait to try to help somebody else, and I thought they were crazy. I've got the greatest rewards in my life since I've been sober by trying to help other people. And you don't brag about it because you don't get a reward from it, but it's certainly been a great reward to me. Yeah, I was born in 1935. My birthday was just a couple of 3 days ago, the 28th of April, 1935. I'm 74 and been sober 34 years, and I'm truly grateful for that. And it's by this program here and the people in it. And a lot of people y'all know, like Henry W. And my old sponsor was a lady named Marie from Aberdeen, Mississippi. I was born in Oxford and grew up in Aberdeen, and I'm back in Oxford now, and I guess I'll stay there. I've been there since 1978. And just to give you just a quick glance at what I've done in my life, I retired from the military after 22 years and went back to college and for 2 years, and then I worked and run the treatment center in the state penitentiary for 18 months and came to Oxford and opened an inpatient alcohol and drug rehab there and ran that for 22 years, and I retired 9 years ago. So I still do a little volunteer work and keep active in the program and try to sponsor a few folks and all that. I like to tell a few little jokes. Is that all right, Milton? Well, I was in the Navy for 22 years, and I was a bad actor, too. I really was. I went in the military for 22 years. Some of you people have been in the military, haven't you? And after 22 years, I retired as an E-4. Now, I don't know if y'all know it. That's about like a corporal in the Army, I guess. I was in the Navy, and I was on a flight crew, and I taught electronics and done all kinds of things. You think a person that's supposed to be intelligent would do a little better than I did, but you see what alcohol did to me? In less than 5 years, when I first went in the Navy, I was already an E-6. On the list to make E-7 in less than 5 years, and after 22, you can tell I had a roller coaster ride. But I'm going to tell you about this sailor real quick. I'm a sailor in the U.S. Navy. This is to Dear Abby. And I also have a cousin who belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. My father has a venereal disease. My mother has epilepsy, so neither of them work. They're totally dependent on my two sisters who are streetwalkers in Louisville. My only brother is serving a life sentence in prison for murder and rape. I am in love with a prostitute who operates near a naval base. She knows nothing of my background, says she loves me, intend to get married as soon as we settle her bigamy case, which is now in court. When I get out of the Navy, we intend to move to Detroit and open a small house. And my problem, Abby, is this. In view of the fact that I intended to make this girl my wife and bring her into the family, should I or should I not tell her about my cousin who's an AA? God. I always liked that one. I might be, you and Russell remind me of Milton and Sparky. I never thought of it that way before, but it's true. Y'all all know Sparky, too. I might do like the guy out in Texas did. He's getting ready to have a big roundup down south. Bend, Texas or somewhere, and they were trying to figure out who to get for this thing to be their Saturday night speaker. And he said, we know this guy. And one guy spoke up and said, this man up there in Oklahoma I know real well, said he's a Cracker Jack speaker. And they finally got a tape, decided they would get this guy to come down and talk for him. He got up there on Saturday night, and this guy gave him a big introduction. He came on up there and didn't say anything, and he just stood there and like he was spellbound. All of a sudden he said, I'm so-and-so. He was spellbound again. He finally said, gave his name, and said he was an alcoholic. He stood around for a while. he looked at you and said, "That's all I got." And I, you know, that's, and he just got up and walked away. So that's what I might do. I'll tell an Al John joke real quick and get going with this, my story, and try not to keep you too long this morning. This Al Anon had a wet alcoholic, and she'd done everything in the world to try to get his attention. You know, you go the wrong way, I understand on that. You try to get your own life together, try to try and fix them. She's trying to fix this guy. And with determination, one morning she left her house and went downtown to a shopping mall and was going to look for something to get his attention. She ended up in a pet shop. And it was snakes and rats and cats and dogs and all kinds of things in there. But something over in the corner got her attention. It was a big-back furry thing sitting on a stool over there. And she asked that guy what that is. She said, "It's a woolly booger." He said, I'll show you some demonstrations. Said he'll only respond to a man's voice. And he said, "I'll show you what he'll do." So there's a cardboard box near that where he was sitting. He said, "Woolly booger, that cardboard box." That thing jumped up and tore that thing all to pieces and slammed it up against the wall. He said, "Just to make sure this ain't fake, I'll do it one more time." He told him, he said, "Woolly booger, that stool you've been sitting on." And the thing jumped up and broke it into kindling. And the lady thought about it a while. She asked him, "How much you want for him?" And they made a little deal there for about $125. So he told him about the sleeping habits and everything, gave him a leash and what he ate and all that, how to treat him. She read him on home. She went home, and that afternoon she was going to fix supper. There's a little foyer between her kitchen and the front door. And she found him a stool just like he had and set him on this stool out there in that foyer. Well, sometime later, so husband of hers come in about half drunk, roaring through the door, and he headed right towards her, and he did a double take. He said, "What in the heck is that?" She said, "A woolly booger." He said, "Woolly booger by ASS. So that's one way to get their attention. Okay. I was raised in Monroe County, Mississippi. I was raised in Aberdeen. I lived in Oxford a lot of my life, and that's where I am today. I grew up in the backwoods, literally, almost on the Alabama state line over there between Vernon, Alabama, and Aberdeen. It's rough territory. It really was over there. They made their own whiskey. I grew up on white whiskey, moonshine, and home brew or anything like that. And then the county below us had plenty of beer and what we used to call, we drank so much white whiskey, we called that bonded whiskey. So I tried it all and lived on the river. Dad and him had a pretty good sized farm down there and they had a fish camp and all that. And I actually started drinking when all his friends from town came out on weekends and they had would throw a big drunk. And I was getting big enough at that time that we could clean up behind them because a lot of them at night passed out before they finished drinking all their stuff. And that's how I got started drinking. And I guess for about 25 years I drank until I got sober at the age of 39. So I was exposed to it at an early age quite often. And I grew up in a rough and tumble life. We didn't have electricity back then on the river down there, and they had these back then square dances. One time they'd have it over Daddy's place in one of his tenant houses, the next time they'd have it across the river. And they'd get started drinking early, and I wasn't big enough, but I always thought that what you did is you had that dance, and every Saturday night they got in a fight after the dance got started. So I thought that was what you're supposed to do, and I've been hurt quite a few times believing all that stuff. So we moved in towards town. Mother was a school teacher. My daddy was a farmer, cattle trader, and whatever else. And he's one of these guys that all my life, I never had any problem with abuse. Daddy never was sober enough to know what he's doing half the time. But he's one of these guys that make a lot of money. He'd be broke one day and have a pocket full of money the next day, and we'd steal it from him. And things like that. And mother's a school teacher, and she run the house. And I looked up to my mother, and she was the guiding light in my life all the way through until I was an adult, because Daddy was incapable of doing it. He died in his early 50s from alcoholism, untreated. He never went through treatment. There wasn't many places to go back then. So that's what happened. Moved in towards town, and I did pretty good in school. Was planning to go to college, and I won't drag it out just on a lot of relationships things, because I didn't have any real problems. I had one brother. Went to school, and I was planning to go to Mississippi State University. A lot of other things came along. Daddy and him had some service stations too as we moved into town, and I got in a lot of trouble over that, and I like to tell it because I'm ashamed that I did it. My brother and another boy worked for me on weekends running two service stations. But they had high school basketball tournaments, football games, and all kinds of things like that. Back in, Western Union had a lot of extras they put on cars and all that stuff. And most people didn't lock their cars. And I had these boys working for me on weekends. They'd go around these places while the ball games are going on, stealing parts, you know, just extras and all that. And I sold them out the back door of my dad and them's service station. And they started bringing in yellow caps. I said, man, don't get the caps off them school buses and all that other stuff too, and make sure it ain't marked. So one Sunday, I got in trouble. I sold something back to the same person that we stole it from, and they turned us in. And then we started stealing boats off the rivers. Had numbers on them. I told the boy to take the numbers off. He just painted over them. He come out and he caught us. So to make a long story short, I was out there at the house one afternoon. There's a long driveway down there to the road, and saw a deputy sheriff turn his car up towards our house. And I told my dad, I said, I wonder who he's looking for. Because we knew everybody, and I figured he's looking to find out where somebody left. He didn't have to go far because he's looking for me. And back then, if you're pretty well known in a community, other than killing somebody, you could probably get away with it if you did it the right way. So they made a deal. They decided that I had just finished high school and joined the National Guard. They decided that I need to leave town, you know. And folks, honest to God, in the military and everywhere else, until I settled down after I retired from the military, I was asked to leave from everywhere I ever was. And when I was in the military, if it was during the Vietnam War, if they needed a flight crew member or somebody overseas at that time, and I was in a squadron and they got a message to send somebody, I went. I was a traveling man because nobody wanted me around. The same way, when I'd get over there, the word was already out on me, and I hate that I was that kind of a person. They'd tell these young guys, says, never go to town with that guy because you don't ever know if you'll ever get back or when you'll get back. So I was left alone. But I went ahead and took them up on that. I went ahead and joined the Navy and got out of this other deal I was in, and spent 22 years, like I said, in there, and I'm not going into a lot of detail on it. I had some good jobs. I did a lot of things. I was already well-seasoned in drinking when I got there. A lot of women said that, well, the Navy got my son, got him in there and taught him how to drink. They didn't have to teach me anything. I was one of the ones that was teaching these others because I already had drank for 7 or 8 years pretty heavily, even in high school. And one thing, too, during the time I was working for my daddy and all them, they treated me real right. I always had a car to drive and money to spend. And I thought that was a life, and that's all I ever wanted to do, was work, get enough money to chase around at night, and drink, and stuff like that. So I got in the military, and after I got in there, I got some pretty good jobs and got some rank. Not a lot of responsibility, and didn't have to do too much hard work. And I said, man, this might be all right. And I started drinking that stuff more and more, I got in trouble right away. And I decided that I had done a good enough job, though, that they let me re-enlist it, and I just stayed in there 22 years. One thing is I had never grown up. I never accepted responsibility and didn't have to in there at all. Somebody else was telling me what we needed to do, and I'd get it done for them, and that's all there was to it. So I didn't grow up. They talk about emotional immaturity. I didn't start growing up till I was 39 years of age when I finally got sober. My mother and my first wife took care of all the responsibility for everything. During that period of time, I was highly trained in the military. I was an instructor on electronics on these surveillance and spy planes. I flew on them. I trained flight crews. And then I got into counseling because I had the gift of gab, I guess they said. And I talked to people to further their education. I talked to people about their financial problems. I talked to people about alcohol and drugs, about marrying people from foreign countries, and all kinds of things like that they asked me to talk to them about and try to persuade them to help them or not marry these people. There's nothing wrong with them, but they had a different lifestyle, a different culture and everything, and we were having a lot of problems with them getting over here and getting married and then getting divorced or be unhappy being here. And I did talk some folks out of going ahead and doing it. And I talked people into getting an education. And I had every opportunity in the world to get a Harvard education. I did get 2 years of college. And I didn't have time to study. I talked to other people about managing their financial situations. I went beyond broke and was forging stuff and facing time in the federal penitentiary for forgery to American embassies and anywhere else that would cash a check for some time. Got in trouble with that. I was encouraging people to get a better education. Took the test to be an officer twice. Passed the test both times. Went out and got drunk, didn't come back for the oral exam in front of the people, so I never did get that. And I just started going downhill, you know. Instead of going up, I started going the other way. But that's just the way things were. And then I talked to people about alcohol and drug abuse. And we was in Southeast Asia a lot, and drugs were real prevalent back then in Southeast Asia. We was having a lot of problems with that. And a lot of people were drinking and stuff like that. So I talked to them about their problems. And I talked to them and counseled them in these clubs where we'd sit there and drink while I was talking about their alcohol problems, which didn't make any sense. That's the way I did it. And y'all manage your finances better. And man, I was in trouble financially and all this other stuff. And by the way, I was talking into marrying these women from foreign countries. I married one, see, after talking to these other people out of it. I married a girl from England. And we had a pretty good marriage. We lived together 3 years out of 10. I thought it was pretty good. 3 out of 10 years. And the funny thing about that, 2 years ago, my wife died. Well, I thought I'd go and I think I paid some more amends, but I'd been in contact because she'd let me know how the grandkids were. I got a son with 2 kids overseas, 11 and 15, I believe, now. And I called her, and we'd been in contact, and I told her I was coming over to see the grandkids, and I asked her to make all the reservations for us to go on a few trips and go to Disney World and whatever it is in Paris and take the kids. And I went over there and hadn't seen my son for a while. It was an enjoyable trip, and I made some amends to her then. I don't think you can make amends after 30 years. That's a pretty long time. But the funny thing was, we got to knowing each other better and better and better. And originally, we was going to get married again. And I went to all this trouble last year, getting the customs things and all done again to get her back over here. Even got her credit cards and got everything fixed up, bought her a whole bunch of new wardrobe and all kind of stuff. And last November, I believe it was, she came back over here, and she hadn't been here but a week, and I saw that she wasn't happy. Wasn't anything to do with me. I knew what it was. She had raised them grandkids from the time they were born. And I said, "You don't look like you're feeling very well or not happy." All she made was a statement like this: "I can't go through with it." I said, "You want me to take you to the airport?" She said, "No, I'll stay a month." I said, "Okay." And that was the end of that. But I have now stayed in contact with them after all these years, and I'm proud that I did. So I married this woman, and like I say, we had a stormy marriage. And then after that, I was alone prior to that in the military, and just went out and partied every night I got a chance to. Didn't have any reins on me at all. And I was with a nuclear submarine outfit at the time. I met her over in Holy Loch, Scotland. That's where I met her. I was with them 2 years, and I got transferred to aviation and did aviation the rest of the time in my career. And my problems manifested themselves real fast in these other places, and mostly in California and Southeast Asia when the war was going on. That's all I did. And I had a lot of blackouts. I had a lot of problems. And I had drank so much by then that I'd go on one of these binges and leave San Francisco and go to Reno and not even know where I stayed, or wake up in a flop house or whatever it was. Might wake up with somebody in the bed that you didn't want to be with and stuff like that. And they said, "Didn't we have a good time last night, honey?" I said, "Yeah." That kind of stuff. And I'm not proud of that either. And my wife was looking for me, and the Navy was calling her and said, "You know where Bill is? We got to go." And he's on flight crew. She said, I don't know either. And I didn't know either. That's the same thing as when I was doing the inventory. I couldn't understand myself, and I couldn't understand why people didn't understand me. And there was no understanding at all about anything. It's kind of like in a true brotherhood, we had none. I was at the top of the heap or the bottom of the stack. I thought, totally dependent on the others, or I thought I had charge of everything. And just all screwed up, and it went from bad to worse and bad to worse. And instead of getting into a long thing, I was in the nightclub and bar business while I was in the military. And when I had time, I took care of my military business, but most of it was my own personal business. I had a nightclub, lounge, restaurant, liquor store. Well, I was an old country boy. And this thing came upon me, how to make a lot of money illegally in the military. I got into what they call usury, loan sharking, loaned in money. I made a barrel of money, and I got enough money to invest in buying my own businesses and made a lot of money, not bragging about it. Due to the fact the way I did it, as much as I was drinking, God took it away from me. And what I thought at that time was the whole world has caved in on me. There's nothing left for me to do. You know, it was just nothing. Everything I look back, everything that I did associated with alcohol, everything. And it just caved in on me. But God took it from me and saved my life. And today, I really believe that. I was devastated at that time. And about the same time that happened, my wife went to England with my only child and wouldn't come back. And if they go over there, you just can't hardly get custody of them. You just forget it, especially somebody like me. So I couldn't do anything about that. So my whole world just caved in when I lost all that, and that just made me drink heavier. So I got out in California. We went to Vietnam, flying out of a base in Japan. See, I don't tell a long drunk a log anymore. Got in there, and I was flying these 12-hour flights along the coastline there in enemy territory. Not eating. Every time we come in, I'd take a shower and go to town and get drunk. In a blackout after a flight one night and being in town drinking, why I did it, I don't know. I turned myself into a hospital there on that base. It was a Marine Corps base. Turned myself in, ended up in that hospital 6 weeks. I hear people talking about DTs. I had DTs. You have DTs, you don't remember anything. When you see and hear things, that's just hallucinations. I went out of it completely. And it's terrible, a terrible thing. And I couldn't eat food hardly for several weeks except on a bland diet. They said my liver was starting to act up and all other kinds of things. And what a fix I realized when I come to my senses. I had two checking accounts, one on American Express and one on Chase Manhattan Bank. And I'd been playing those things against each other and come to find out neither one of them had any money on it. I was writing on one against the other one until they finally caught me. A commanding officer come over and talked to me. He was an alcoholic, and I was on his flight crew, and he said, I want you to get straightened out and come back and fly with me. I knew why, because me and him are old drinking buddies. He said, by the way, your wife called from England. She wants some money. And they got you charged with all this other stuff because you wasn't there for a flight, and I don't know what I'm going to do about that. And the doctor said that I had to stay in the hospital because I wasn't able to fly. And then I was getting a little better. This Marine come over, big old Marine sergeant, introduced himself, made a 12-step call. I didn't know what it was. Then wanted to know if I'd go to a meeting with him. And I agreed to go. Got over there. There they were. You know, I didn't tell you my past history on this thing about God. A lot of people say I have trouble finding out or understanding who God is. I had too much understanding of it. It just drove me crazy, guilt, after I got sober. I used to sing gospel music a lot, me and my brother. I've done public speaking all my life, in the military and everywhere. We got in there, and they was reading about God. And I was nervous then. And the Marine looked at me and said, that's okay, you don't have to say anything. And I was glad I didn't, because I felt so much guilt, you know. And I couldn't figure out, when they talk about this stuff in step 2 and 3 in the AA literature, the big book, and the 12 and 12, about God and how much of a struggle it was for some people. Because it says some of them have very little understanding, and they don't expect you to understand it right away. And others just have guilt as a result of it and screws them up. I couldn't figure this out because I'd always believed in God. And that's just lip service. That's all that is. I could tell you I'm an alcoholic today, and I believe in God. That's just lip service. If I can't, in my innermost self, accept that and use it in my daily life, ain't nothing to it, no way. It's just blowing smoke. But I found out that I was doing what they say in step 7. I had barren faith. I was going around professing to have a belief in God, but I was still playing God myself. And that was the big dilemma. The other thing was a crippling handicap of humility. I put material things above character and spiritual principles. And that's why I lost it. That's why I lost it. Material things were my God, money, prestige and all that, and false ego, and God took it away from me. Now, character and spiritual principles play out much stronger than material things. I love material things. If me and God have control of it, I can have anything known to mankind. But if I ever let it rise up again and take charge of me again, I'm a goner. And I know that. But after that blackout and all that stuff, they decided it was going to send me off anyway, because that's too bad of a case. So they sent me to California under guard. But I wasn't suicidal, but they took everything away from me and had a guard with me all the way down there. I said, what are you with me? He said, well, you're a danger to yourself and others. So they told me that I was the one taking you down there. And I got down there, and it was the same treatment center that the president's wife and that other president's brother went to. He's dead now. Y'all know who I'm talking about. On a Navy base down there, and I stayed there 13 weeks. I was introduced to AA. Every counselor there was on active duty in the military, and all of them are recovering, or recovered. The book, our big book says recovered, so I feel like I'm recovered, but a lot of people say recovering. That's their business. I don't want to stay recovering the rest of my life. I want to get recovered and enjoy life and not have to worry about that every day. But I went there. I didn't want to be there. I was in total denial. I was one of these guys that was raised one way. Drank, raised hell, and you have to suffer the consequences. That's just part of the way you live, so you got to expect some fallout from it. And my second treatment centers later, I'll talk about it. The problem got too great to bear, and then that's when I was ready for help. But I went through this program, and I faked my way through it to a degree. I've got a pretty good memory, and I memorized these steps and a lot of how it works and certain things in the book that would get the counselor's attention. And I already knew how to do this talking and stuff like that. So I faked my way through it and even got to talking so well that they asked me to go downtown Long Beach and make a talk. And my counselor was sitting there and all that, and I really impressed them. Didn't impress them so much about 2 weeks later when I got drunk on antabuse. They let me go to town. I drank a couple of beers. I thought it was out of my system because I'd been putting it in my fingers or under my tongue and I'd swallowed it. It was set up to drink. So I ordered a beer, got another beer, no problem. I said, give me a shot of whiskey. See how that'll do. I drank about two of them, and I tell you what, I thought my heart was going to jump out of my chest. I turned beet red all over, and I've never been that sick before in my life. Because anybody thinks that they want to do it, see what that stuff will do to you, I don't suggest it. So I got that, and I said, well, I got about 18 years in the military. They're going to kick me out without any retirement. So I went, they got me back out there after they got me out of the emergency room and said, we're going to set you back 2 weeks to 13 weeks. Obviously, I wasn't ready to quit drinking because when I left there, after that 2 weeks, they gave me all my back pay and my flight pay because I was on permanent flight duty. Well, I got to the airport. I was supposed to join a squadron in right outside San Francisco. And I was kind of torn between where I was going to go. There's two or three places in Mexico, Las Vegas, and all that up on billboards out there. I said, well, I'll just go to Mexico. So I went in the lounge to talk it over. It took me off antabuse then. And I got drunk, and I got out there to board the plane. They wouldn't let me board the plane because I was drunk and had to stay overnight. I finally got down to Mexico for about a week. Ended up back in San Diego in a drunk tank being detoxed. The Navy got a hold of me and held me there. And again, I was put under guard and put to another squadron. So I came here. That's when I started counseling. After I just quit drinking. And I got there and they said, the commanding officer wants to see you. Of course, you know, I had a lot of experience in my portfolio, instructor, all this background and education, all that. And I walk in his office and I figured he was going to dress me down because I was 7 days late getting there. And I'm standing there at attention. He said, just relax and sit down. He just looked me straight in the eye. It's funny. He says, can you not drink and control it and behave yourself? I said, it don't look like it, does it? But he said, I stayed with him, and he's a pretty good guy. They sent me to, want me to go to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I was still taking antabuse. Then they found out that you couldn't take antabuse and fly, so they took me off that. But I was still going to a few meetings. I made sure they knew I went. I didn't get any papers signed, but I was going. One day over there, he had appointed me to be his counselor because he had seen that I'd done it before. And I was always on the edge because I was over at the barracks. We wasn't flying that day, and I had my feet propped up on a desk in there where the guy was on duty, and we were just talking. And the phone rang. He said, the commanding officer wants to see you. For a guy with a vast record of mine, immediately when he said the commanding officer wants to see you, I said, oh, my goodness. But I got over there, and I'm going to tell you all what the thing was, how good a counselor I was. I walked in, and he said, come on in, Smith. He treated me like, you know, I flew with him some. He said, sit down. He said, I got a real problem. I said, well, tell me what it is, sir. He said, we got a bowling league for the squadron everywhere on Thursday night. It's a bowling alley. He said, I got a real problem. He said, you know old so-and-so? I said, yeah, he's a mech on the night shift. He works on the engines on the airplanes. He said, yeah, it's him. He said, he does all right when we first get started, but see, he's starting to hit that beer over there. And he's in the lane next to me, and they know he's in my squadron. And he said the other night he started to bowl the ball, and I was really embarrassed, Smitty. He said him and the ball both got down in the gutter there and with the ball still in his hand. And he said, I want to put a stop to it. I said, I can take care of that real easy. I guess he wondered how in the world I could do it. I said, I waited around that night till the guy come in to work. It's called night check. That's like second shift in factories. I said, come here, I want to talk to you. He said, I got other things to do. I said, this is more important. The commanding officer wants me to talk to you. You better come on over here. We sat down and talked for a while. I asked him about being down there. I said, you bowling next to the commanding officer? I said, yeah. I said, you fell in the alley, the gutter there, didn't you? Yeah, one time. I said, look, man, I'm going to make real brief with you. This is not going to take long at all. I said, if you ever go over and drink anything again, I got a place that I can send you. I said, I've been in one, and I don't know if you want to be in there or not. You're going to be away from your wife and kids for about 11 weeks. They're going to keep you there, and you can't go anywhere. I said, if you're caught over there again, you're going. 2 or 3 weeks later, I saw the commanding officer. I said, if you had any more problems, I said, I hadn't had a bit of problem. Now, ain't that awful to be that kind of counselor on threats? Rather than telling the guy what he needed to do, but I didn't know any better. So we went all that, and I got back over in Southeast Asia, and make it briefly. I left the military. I literally left the military. I lived with the natives for a little while there. That's when I was writing all those checks on American Embassy and all that. Got caught, put in treatment again, sent to Florida. Exposed to a good treatment program the Navy had in Jacksonville, Florida. I went there with the same attitude, though. Went there with the same attitude. A know-it-all, and they started talking about me. So I was there a few weeks, and they gave me the job of cleaning up the commanding officer's office. And things went well, but I got in there on Monday morning one thing. And that's one of the reasons I'm standing here today, I'll tell you the truth. After all the things that I had seen and written down about me, the good and bad, and their top outpatient thing, he had my weekly evaluation done. Know it all, that's all of that stuff, ego and whatever else. I didn't tell anybody about it. I slept on it for a couple of days, and I went to my counselor, and he got some other counselors in there because he knew I was a pretty slick talker, and they dressed me down and told me to shut up, I didn't know anything, and a lot of other nice things, a little vulgarity with it. You can't leave, you can't say, well, you're not going to talk to me that way. If you do, they'll lock you up. So what I did is, I don't know, for those little experiences right there, I don't know if I had I didn't have a spiritual awakening, but it got my attention. And I prayed about it that night. And for some reason, things started to change. I started to take an interest in it. I also found out my ex-wife was still in England. She wasn't going to bring the child back. Only job I had was running a bar in Baltimore, Maryland for a friend of mine, which wouldn't have worked. I had nothing else. And I couldn't fly anymore because they took my secret clearance away. I couldn't get on an airplane. They didn't have any use for me in the Navy. And I figured I might not even get my retirement, but they did give me my retirement, which I don't know if I deserved it. I did do a lot of good work for them, but don't know. So I left there with $200, a suitcase of clothes, and headed up to Mississippi. Mother had an extra house she wasn't living in. They put me in that, and I went back to school for 2 years. But I joined AA right away in Aberdeen, Mississippi. Some people here know, I call him my sponsor. He's my contact. He's a veterinarian in Aberdeen, Mississippi, about 40-something years sobriety. Got in contact with him and a lady that had been in the program a long time, and they took me to meetings and put me under their arms. And after I got stabilized, they assigned me with, I didn't even have a vehicle. My mother had to buy me an old pickup to ride in. And I was assigned the duty of picking up a guy named Old Albert and taking him to meetings in another town. Stuff like that. And I think that kept me in the AA program until I could stabilize and get on my feet. So they showed me the ropes of what AA is really all about. Trust God, clean house, and help others. I don't get into all this fancy stuff and quote pages in the book anymore and all that. I know about one-tenth of what I thought I used to know. See, I was armed with all the facts at one time, but I don't know that now. You know, my program's so simple compared to what it was when I first come in. As time went on, I learned more and more about the program and knew less about all this other stuff that was trivial anyway. But that's how I got started. And we had step discussions and all that, and I went through all the steps and did a written inventory and did a step 5 in treatment, and I was satisfied with that. Down in Florida, and it was good, and it worked, and it's the same way with me as it would be for a person with three or four years in the program or more. If they're happy, and you see them somewhere, you can just about bet that they have worked through the steps, and that they're active in AA, and they're doing something to get a reward back from. Just about always, you can bet that they did it that way, and that's the truth. So, old guy from Chicago, Illinois, I heard talk years ago, said if you don't work the steps, you suffer from untreated alcoholism. And I don't like to play on words either, but it's really the fact. I've been running a step study discussion for over 31 years now, and I learn something new from somebody all the time. And I'll just give you an example. This old boy, country boy, coming to meetings, and was doing step 10, and come around to him after I introduced it that night, and he said, yeah, I want to say something, Mr. Bill. I said, well, go ahead. He said, I think I'm making progress on this step. I think I'm making progress in AA. I said, how is that? He said, I reckon I am because I don't have to admit that I'm wrong near as much as I used to. I said, you're probably making a little bit of progress if you don't do that. You're not quite as bad. But that's one of those things. That's how I got here, and I stayed in that group for 2 years, and then I moved to Oxford, and I've been in the College Hill 12 and 12 group by the name of 12 and 12. It's steps, traditions, and steps. That's all we do. We don't have general discussions. To me, general discussions is just like opening up a can of worms. And I hear people today chair and meet and say, talk about anything you want to. I said, well, I got to go do something else. I'll see y'all later. Because I know what's going to come up. No telling what. The biggest mess I've ever seen. So and I'm proud to be in that group. And after I got through, I went to college for 2 years and worked and run the state penitentiary treatment center for about 18 months. These jobs came up all over the state of Mississippi. They had got some money and were opening up treatment programs, inpatient. I applied. I didn't know it was so easy to get one. I'd had some background, but I applied for a job in Oxford. And immediately I got the thing, and I stayed there 22 years, and I was offered a job in 3 or 4 others because they just didn't. At that time in the state of Mississippi, there weren't that many trained personnel to run those things, you know, and I helped train a lot of them, and I'm proud of where they're at with it. I quit 9 years ago. I do some volunteer work today. But I got involved with that. And I had ended up divorcing this other lady that I spoke about right after I got to Oxford. She didn't want to come back even after I'd been sober 2.5 years. I'm kind of like, oh boy, was going to AA, one of these that never said anything. Well, there's a lot of people open up, said, anybody got anything pressing they need to talk about tonight? He raised his hand in the back of the room and he caught the guy as a chairman off guard. He said, yeah, I do. They said, what are you all uptight about? He said, hell, all y'all talk about is getting your wife back, and I don't want mine back. I'm getting out of here. About the same way with me. I got, of all things, I got divorced after 2.5 years of sobriety. But that's the way it goes. And I met this other nice lady that Joanne and them knew. She stayed active in Al-Anon, real active for about 19 years. And she got this disease of asthma and breathing emphysema and all that other stuff. And she died about 2 years ago. And I'm not bragging again. I thought of her caretaker when I wasn't working. Of course, the treatment center was right next door to my house. So that sure did help a lot. And I thank God gave me the strength to deal with that. Those things are difficult and all that. So I ran the treatment center for 22 years and thoroughly enjoyed it. But I never did feel like it was the best thing for me to do to come to an AA gathering and take any credit or have anything to do with the treatment program. That's not my AA. I did my AA separately. I sponsored people and things like that and left all that at home. But even though while I was in the treatment center, I'd get up and I was going to try to make a little talk, and I found myself almost ordering the people in there to do things, and I said, that's not going to work. I've just got to go up there and tell my story and leave all that other crap of mine outside of there. So I finally got to the point where I could do that. And I don't think I really ever started working my AA program to any degree until I retired and be an AA and AA only. And I really believe that because that's all I did. And I'm still doing that today and got some people I sponsor, and I believe in sponsorship. I believe in three things: home group, singles purpose, and sponsorship. If I say singles purpose in some places today, of course, I've been sober so long, they're not going to say anything to me, but they all get shocked and get uptight and all that stuff. That's what the book says. Well, I said, so-and-so says. I said, I'm not saying anything. I said this. This is what AA said. I've never made a statement of what I said. We got these other people, too. They've got to hang up on this we thing. Kid the other night, a few years ago, I said, we are all this or that or the other. I said, you ever heard of the word I? You speak for yourself and I'll speak for my own self. Don't tell me what I am when you don't know. But that's another thing they do today. I don't know where they're getting all this stuff from. They've told me a lot of stuff in recent years about AA that I've never read, never heard of. And I asked them where they got it. I know how to get on them. I said, well, what book did you read out of? Because I'd like to read up on what you just told me. Blah, blah, blah. Joe said that this, but I said, what out of the AA literature? They can't tell you. But I'm not getting up here to preach about that tonight. I'm satisfied with AA the way it's written. Exactly. I don't have to change anything. Now we got some people, and the ladies, I got all the respect in the world for them. They hadn't added it in the big book, I think, but where it says men, they've added and women. I had to get on about that, too. I said they got a footnote in one of the literatures explaining why. It's not that they don't have as much or more respect for the women. If they start changing one thing, they're afraid if they change that, then something else will go on down the line. And I know a guy that ran a treatment center, came in there and said, well, we're going to stop doing the surrender prayer. We're going to do another prayer. He hadn't been there 3 months, and he ended up getting drunk. So there's a lot of things. I don't think a lot about my recovery. I ask God every morning to give me the strength and guidance to get through the day. I know it's up to me to carry it out. He's done it over 34 years. So my faith in God and the program has certainly increased over the years. I did the inventories and come to terms with step two and step three. I like to tell you something about step three. Step three opened up the gates and let me out. It set me free from that self-imposed prison I was in. I don't ever have to go back in it again. Also, the place where I made a decision to make a personality change under spiritual supervision, because whether it was little or more, I had God on my side. and just the inkling of having God on my side was able to do a fearless inventory. And today I know I can't do anything of a fearless nature without God on my life. Satan made a fearless inventory. So what happened is, as I see in step three, when I reached it, had all this trouble, all these worries, and always uptight. And I was channeling all that stuff inside because I had this false ego and wouldn't tell anybody because I thought too much false pride to tell anybody how screwed up I was and how I felt inside. And that's where I began to make that release. And some people have said, and I thought so too, if I do this decision about God, it's not going to leave me much of a chance to do anything on my own. Old guy a long time ago told me something that I've stuck with ever since. He said that we have a wide range to roam every day and carry out things, and that we can manage all our ordinary affairs without having to consult God. So when I look at it, really, I use my own will in a lot of things daily without consulting God. What I do is, I know where the limb is that it's just chopped off. I know where the gray area is, and I sense it. I intuitively know these other things that you better leave that alone, Bill. So I know where I stand, so God takes care of all of that, because I tried to do all that, get my marriage back, my wife back, military career stopped, didn't work on my own. So that's the way I work that part. I know I turn my life over to God daily in step 11. I did the inventory, did good step fives, and I know Mitchell and them have, Milton and them have retreats every year. I consult people, you update these things, and going on through the steps and all that. I made all my amends, and I want to talk briefly about that. I'm not going to go through, usually when I talk, but this is a convention, I go through all the steps and make that my life in it. But the main thing is I didn't have a very big family. And I depended on my mother all my life. And I had this wife that I spoke of a while ago. I found out my mother was sick, and I moved her over to Oxford, Mississippi with me. And me and my wife took care of her. Shortly after we got there, we found out she had terminal cancer. And we took care of her until a day or two before she died. I called the ambulance, and they come and took her to the hospital, and my wife was down there and called me, and my brother was in town, and we went down there, and she didn't have life support, so I was there when she died that morning. And see, I couldn't handle that, and had this program in God. So last time at the funeral that I viewed her body in the casket, I looked back, and this is the honest to God truth, I'm not being moral, but I had no regrets. I'd been sober about 12 and a half years, and I had no regrets. And I thought and she had told me how proud she was of me. So I had no regrets. That really cleared up a big deal for me right there, even though I'd already made amends prior to that. And I think my wife had accepted my amends years ago, too. So the biggest thing was money. I'd gotten in a lot of trouble. Mother bailed me out and kept me from going to federal penitentiary. And everything just fell in place for me. And I've been blessed ever since then. You know, I was flat broke, and I'm completely, I'm not completely, but in good financial shape today. I've been blessed. I could have been dead from this thing or never had anything, or like I told the lady this morning, I certainly wouldn't have had enough money to get up here just to come to convention or anything else and go and do as I please. I travel a lot. I do volunteer work. I go to all the ball games everywhere and travel to Europe and whatever else I want to do. And it's all because you people helped me. See, everybody took me by the hand and helped me. As smart as I was, you know, that was one of the things that I wish I did have a high IQ and did a lot of important things in my life. But I wish never, I think it was a bad thing that somebody ever told me that I was pretty intelligent, because I believed that stuff. It damn near killed me. See, you can get into all that sort of thing, too. So I stayed active in the program. A lot of people I know today with a lot of sobriety that are still able to get around. I commend all these old-timers and young people, but a lot of the older people, I got some in Oxford. They quit going to meetings. And that's sad. They quit going to meetings. They might show up for a speaker meeting occasionally, but they're sad. They could do a lot of good for people by the example, and I think we lead by example. So I told a different kind of story today. You know why? I've told these stories so much I'm tired of listening to them. So I thought I'd just change it up a little bit so I wouldn't have to hear it again. And now all the way back to Oxford, I'll be depressed probably. And I'll do like I used to. I'll be cursing myself under my breath all the way. I said, Bill, you screwed up your life, didn't you? No, I'm happy today. My wife died 2 years ago. I got a lady friend. She couldn't be with me. And I'm happy. And I have to tell you, she's 31 years younger than I am. But she's my caretaker. I guess you'd call her that. But I'm happy. No, but I'm really happy. It's good to see all of y'all. I see a lot of people here that I know personally. And I don't know how long. We've been about an hour now. Okay. It's about time to quit. I just don't like to talk. When I taught school, I found out that we had 50-minute classes. For anybody, when they get over an hour, I noticed that before I tried it. Little by little, they lose your attention. Lose your attention. So I think I better quit. And I know y'all will be proud of that. And more than my talk today, and I hope I didn't bore you too much, I can tell you all kind of stories, but I just didn't get into it. One thing I will tell you, it's funny. I tell these new people in treatment centers. I said, this old guy from Memphis, Tennessee, was getting committed to Western State Hospital over in Bolivar, Tennessee, for alcohol addiction. And he got over there. He's waiting in line for his soft shoes and pajamas over there. Something got his attention. There was somebody in a holding cell by their cell. Well, he saw this guy, and the guy's up there with his ear to the wall like he's listening to music or somebody talking through that wall. By chance, that old drunk got put in that same holding cell. And he paced around there for quite a while. Then he put his ear up the wall and listened for about 5 minutes. He looked at this other guy. He looked over and said, I don't hear anything. The old guy said, hell, it's been that way all day. Now, this is. I'm going to tell one more joke because people need to round up with something. This is. It's not any cursing in it, but somewhere up in the Midwest, you know, a lot of couples. And when I lived in Baltimore, they did a lot of that too. And I know up in the Midwest and bowling and different things. Well, they decided, the husband and wife decided that they were going to pick their night to go out. So the husband finally decided he'd go bowling on Thursday night. His wife decided she'd go to this bingo thing on Friday night. So the thing started going along. It seemed like it was working real well. Then on a Saturday morning, after she'd been to bingo, he noticed on the counter there's a big diamond ring. She said, where'd you get that diamond ring? He said, I want it playing bingo. He didn't think a whole lot about it. A few weeks later, he saw a fur coat hanging up over it. He said, well, where'd you get that? She said, and bingo. Well, you know, his curiosity got more and more and more. And sometime later, to beat all, he happened to get up that morning and go out, and there's a Cadillac sitting out there by the curb. Naturally, you know what she said. She wanted to play bingo. And he thought, this is ridiculous. So a week later, she was getting ready to go play bingo, and she was in a hurry. Said, honey, would you run some water for me in the bathtub? And she went in there to take a bath. There's about that much water in the bottom of the tub. She said, why didn't you fill that bathtub up? He said, honey, I don't want to get your bingo card wet. I'll see y'all.